Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. I've got a special one for you this week. I talked to Mike Randall today. Mike Randall is a solo artist. He is in the band Baby Lemonade, who ended up backing up Arthur Lee and being the new version of Love, famous 1960s band. But when Arthur and Baby Lemonade got together, they really jump-started Arthur's career and really helped cement the legacy of Love. And even though Arthur has passed away in 2006, Baby Lemonade and original Love member Johnny Eccles are out on tour. They're usually billed as Love with Johnny Eccles. You can go to lovewithjohnnyeccles.com and get the information. So they're just at the tail end of an East Coast tour, and this is a short interview to get things started that just talks about what they're up to right now. Mike is a solo artist. He is in the band Baby Lemonade, and he's done lots of work with Love, so there's plenty to talk about. So you're going to hear that first. That is just from this week, 2025. And then you're going to hear Mike in 2006 talk about how Arthur Lee had passed away. And then you're going to hear Johnny Eccles from 2009, and we'll talk all about the history of Love. And then you're going to hear a final interview with Mike Randall from 2017. So four interviews. We should get the whole history of Mike Randall's life and of the band Love. So stay tuned. Again, it's lovewithjohnnyeccles.com if you're interested in buying some merch or seeing if they're playing somewhere near you. And just love the band, so hope you will too. Talk soon. Yeah, there is Love. Live and Let Live. Before that, Que Vida, and I believe Mike Randall of Love joins us on the telephone. Mike, are you there?
Hey, Michael, I'm here.
We're off to a good start then. Those just sound like really fun songs to play live, am I right?
Oh, yeah. They're really amazing. I enjoy listening to what you're just playing now.
Do you guys play that? Do you guys play the same set every night? Have you been varying it up? How deep are you going?
We're going deep. We do some deep stuff. We've been doing 90%+ of the same set list because, you know, you want to get better and better at it, and it's just the stuff that we think we like and that people want to hear. We have been throwing in some deep cuts like Feathered Fish, which was never released by Love, and some surprise stuff, like some outtakes songs from Forever Changes.
It sounds great. Now, I want to remind folks that I did speak with Johnny Eccles in August of 2009. You were on the show in August 2006 after Arthur Lee passed away, and you were also on in December of 2017. So we have talked about Love and you, and if folks want sort of the deeper dive when you're not in a van driving somewhere, they should tune into the archives of those programs. Tonight at the Kung Fu Necktie in Philadelphia, and then tomorrow at the Cutting Room in New York, Monday at Space Ballroom in Hamden. Mike, make sure you get some pizza that night, and then Boston on the 7th at the City Winery. So when is the first time you met Arthur Lee? What year was that?
That was April 29th, 1993. We opened up for that version of his band, which was called Arthur Lee in Love, but it was Arthur with a guy named Justino on drums, and then Robert Rozell and Mel Van Whittington, guys that played with him in the 70s, in the mid-70s, and throughout, yeah.
And what happened? He just saw you guys and he thought, okay, this is more what I need?
Well, it's funny. We were at the Troubadour, and I don't know if you've been to the Troubadour, you know, like upstairs, the dressing room has a glass window and you can see the bands playing. And Jeff, our old manager, Jeff Davis, who you know,
unfortunately,
was up there with Arthur watching us, and Arthur says to him, I like these guys. They remind me of my original band. I'm tired of playing with these dope fiends. The next day he called Jeff, said, hey, I want to jam with Baby Lemonade. Let's see what happens. And we did. And then he called later that night. And that was that.
Here we are 30 years later. Yeah, amazing. Yeah, I mean, these songs are so incredible and so different. And I don't know if you've been, if you guys have been tuning into the show, but I was just listening to a song and I was saying, you know, a lot of times people compare Love to The Doors because they were on Elektra Records together. And to me, Love is just such a much more interesting band. Do you agree?
Yeah.
And then second question, who is coming to see the shows? Because this is now 30 years since you started.
Very good question. First of all, The Doors were definitely different than Love. I think Love had more depth. And a lot of the fans are, you know, like both bands, but there's a couple of songs I like by The Doors, but I don't really compare them to Love. And that's not a diss on them. I don't find their music as interesting, not nearly as interesting as Love. I'd heard The Doors my whole life, and then my friend played me Orange Skies, and I went, what the hell is that? And then I had to have more, you know?
Yeah.
I had to have more, and then I just dug it deeper into it, and so did Rusty. That was in the 80s, and, you know, and yeah, we started playing in 93, and, you know, we've been, and then our last show with Arthur was in 2005, and he passed away less than a year later. He's sadly missed, but, you know, the fans have been appreciative and coming out. Last night, like 20% of the audience were like under age 25, and this whole band, these kids, they're 18, their whole band came to the show, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of what I think that he's kind of having a little bit of a moment, or at least Love is kind of getting rediscovered in a way. I guess it's just a cyclical thing. So you spent a million years with this guy. I know you guys played a lot in Europe, so you were in planes and vans and stages and hotels. Like, I met him just briefly a couple times. He just seemed like a little bit of like a bizarre guy, you know, just like a little bit of a goofball. I mean, but did you get a window into how Arthur Lee wrote these songs, or where they came from, or what his genius was?
You know, I think he obviously that was a different time. You know, that was in the 60s, and Arthur's writing style changed when he changed musicians. You know, so that era, those first three records, they don't sound like anything else, and that's because those musicians didn't play like anyone else that he played with. But, you know, he continued to do music and everything. And Rusty and I worked with him as well as working on songs and writing. And Arthur's mind is like, you know, he does a lot of stream of consciousness, I think, when he was writing. And he kind of has visuals, and he kind of matches the words with them. And he's good at wordplay and melodies, very good at melodies and beautiful voice. And so when you pair him with musicians who have different influences and bring different things to the table, incredible things can happen, I think.
It's interesting that you give a lot of credit on those first records to the band, because so often it's kind of looked at as Arthur is the guy telling everyone what to do, you know?
Well, you know, if you took... it's funny, we were listening to Nick Drake last night, and if you just took Nick Drake and the guitar, you'd have those songs. But when you listen to all the instrumentation, like Richard Thompson and the production and the bass playing and all of the strings, everything on top of it, then you have the finished product, and it's amazing, and it's actually a combination of all those talents with the songs that you're listening to, you know?
Yeah, definitely a real collaborative... Definitely collaborative thing.
I think musically, I mean, when someone gets a lot of credit for something, they don't really, like, probably may not want to share credit, but I know from a musician standpoint, that those parts, and you listen to, any person that knows music can listen to those parts and know that all those musicians brought a lot to the table and made the songs make the records great records, you know?
Yeah.
It could have just been good songs with good records. Instead, they're great songs with great records because of everything, all the contributions and just that they were a great band. They would play together, you know what I mean? Like the Grateful Dead played together, like the Doors played together.
I was just listening to the drums in the headphones of some of those love songs that I was playing earlier in the show, and that the drums are just, that guy is underrated, man. That those drum parts are so fabulous and so signature.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So what's the most...
I was listening to Live and Let Live when you were playing your show. And now I don't want to play guitar on it because listening to Johnny play the original part, and I played it so differently for years, and then when Johnny rejoined the group like 25 years ago, it's kind of like a combination of how I did it and what he does. And I'm listening like going, well, maybe I shouldn't play right there.
Well, it is interesting when you are, but that's kind of one of the things I love about when you started to back up Arthur Lee, because I've seen you guys many times, is that you don't recreate the record necessarily. You create what the record would have sounded like live then, with a little more of a kick in the pants, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so great, yeah. So it's a real live experience. So what is the most complicated love song to play? What has the most chords?
I would say the most challenging love song that we've played by far is two of them. One is The Castle. I would say that for sure. And I mean, that was one we had to practice a lot. And like, you know, we're still messing up in rehearsal. But we played live. It was great. So we got it. The other one is Laughingstock. And that was a B-side. Hey, what was Laughingstock a B-side of? That was the B-side of Your Mind and We Belong Together.
Hmm. Yeah, he just puts a lot of weird time changes and pushes and chord changes, but it all seems like it's not like in a Berklee School of Music way. You know, it's just a very intuitive kind of a way. Yeah.
Yes. That's funny because we were listening to Nick Drake, I said last night, and there's a song that he does. And it's five bars. So the first bar, he doesn't start singing. He starts singing the second bar. So to him, he's singing four bars. But to the listener, there's actually five bars, which is odd, but it's natural. I don't think he did it intentionally because he wanted to be different. It's just the way he wrote the song.
Yeah, John Lennon did a lot of that stuff. A lot of that weird...
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can't count those songs. The website is lovewithjohnnyeccles.com, and tonight at Kung Fu Necktie in Philly, tomorrow Cutting Room in New York City, Space Ballroom on Monday and Wednesday at the City Winery in Boston. Let's talk about the best meal you've been served in a club and the worst meal on this tour. Yeah.
Oh, man, the best meal we've been served, I'm trying to think, what's the best meal? Well, it wasn't really a meal, but we were in Appleton, Wisconsin, which is just like half an hour from Green Bay. It was a brewery, and they gave us cheese curds that they make.
Oh,
amazing.
That's great.
That was amazing. I can't say that we've received from the venues any great meals. Although last night they had a taco bar and it had vegan and meat options, and it was really good. It's just that the people who made the tacos were not very nice, but that's okay. So that was good.
You guys are from LA. I'm surprised to hear you say that you got great tacos on the East Coast.
Yeah, I'm from Cali. It was great. They were really good. They were throwing down. They just were very nice. But as far as the worst food, I don't know. I'm trying to think. Oh, well, it used to be the Beachland Ballroom because they used to make that baked chicken. But they started doing chicken tenders now and had a nice little organic salad and some rice. So I can't say we've had a really bad meal. We did stop at Taco Bell and it got our tour manager sick. If he's English, he's never really made that run for the border.
Uh-oh.
Well, he made it this time, but not in the way he wanted to.
Man, to me, Taco Bell is the best fast food, especially if you don't like to eat meat. You know, that's where everybody's happy in Taco Bell, except for your tour manager.
Yeah. Well, you know, also Taco Bell is a place where you can get a nice little bean and cheese burrito and not have to worry about it, you know?
Yeah, tell me about it. Crunchwrap Supreme all day long for me, you know?
Crunchwrap Supreme, baby. I'm you know, you had me at hello.
Exactly. Okay, I want people to go see this band. I know that somebody, listener baby on the message board, was testifying how much he enjoyed the show at somewhere in California. Tell me, Baby Lemonade, which is a band you've been playing with for a million years. You guys are doing the opening, a little bit of a short opening set. Is that right?
Yes.
We heard Underground DJ earlier. Man, I forgot how much I love that song.
What song was it?
Underground DJ.
Oh, yeah. We're not doing that song. It's funny, man, but thank you. I did see that because, you know, we used to be on the same label with you back in the 90s on Big Deal. And I saw that our old label boss, Dean Brown Ralph, posted promoting this interview and our tour and everything. That was really nice of him.
Yeah, well, people love, and, you know, I don't know how many more chances we're going to get to see the original Johnny Eccles playing with Love, but this next few days is a great opportunity to do that. Is he doing stuff on the guitar that you wouldn't have thought of doing? I mean, you kind of mentioned that earlier. Are you watching his fingers? Yeah. Because those guys met in high school, right? Him and Arthur met in high school and were playing in, like, you know, Beatles-y bands is what I assume they sort of sounded like.
Yeah. Could you get me an oat milk latte? We're stopping at Starbucks. They're going to get me a latte.
Get the oat milk.
Yeah. You know, Johnny has a background. And I think all those guys had a sort of a background in not just jazz, but they're also big classical fans. So you had Brian McClain, who was a very good, like, flamenco guitar player. And you got Johnny that can play that style, but Johnny can also play jazz, because Johnny played with Miles Davis in the 70s, you know, Love.
Okay.
I don't know, a lot of people know that. And then Michael Stewart, the drummer, was a very Latin-influenced drummer, if you listen to his playing. He sounds like two people sometimes. And then Arthur was listened to the classics like Johnny Mathis. He was a big Johnny Mathis fan. He liked Sinatra. He liked Ella Fitzgerald, but he also liked Cole Porter. And a lot of his wordplay, I think, comes from his love of, like, Cole Porter.
It's interesting. So, like, Cole Porter plus lots of drugs equals love.
Yeah. I don't comment on any drugs.
I don't expect you to. Yeah. if folks can go to, like I said, lovewithjohnnyeccles.com for information and confirmation and buy tickets and get the addresses of all these places, etc. Yeah. Anything we need to know about what's happening in LA?
There's, you know what I'm finding out? I mean, you get out of L.A. and you realize every town you go to has a great music scene. Chicago, Minneapolis, even like around Green Bay and Cleveland. All these bands that either have been big fans, some people have seen us from years ago, and then there's people who are just discovering it, and they're getting an opportunity to see an original member like Johnny Eccles. Play these songs, and you hear Johnny play, and it sounds like the record. I mean, because he did it. He did those parts. So it's really a treat, and we do like extended versions of songs like The Red Telephone, where Johnny just really adds something that you're not going to hear on the record. And he's really stretching out the guitar playing on this tour, and people are digging it, and we really dig it. And we're enjoying it as much as the crowd. As far as tonight, Philadelphia, Kung Fu, Necktie, go Birds. That's what I was told to say. Go Birds.
Be careful. That town is a town. Eagles. That is a crazy. Last time I was there, everybody was wearing Eagles. I mean, everybody. During game day.
Oh, yeah.
And my friend who I met who lives there said, oh, yeah, if you go to a bank, you know, the week of a game, everyone who works in the bank is dressed in Eagles stuff. It's another level over there. So don't say anything wrong on stage. You're going to get, you know, trouble.
I think years ago, you and I went to a Philly cheesesteak place in Philly. I want to say we did, like a real, like one of those famous ones or something.
Yeah, I think so.
For people who don't know, you and I have been friends for a long time.
Yeah, we've eaten a lot of meals together. Yeah, a lot of pie, a lot of road food. Yeah. All right, Mike Randall, one of my favorites. Yeah. Like I said, if check out Mike's solo records, check out the Baby Lemonade records, check out Love on tour right now. I know, you want to hear Orange Skies since you mentioned it a little bit earlier?
I would love to hear Orange Skies. I would love to hear it. And we do that song. We do half of the first album. We do a few cuts from Da Capo. We do most of Further Changes. And then we do some post-John, original band stuff, that like Arthur stuff, For Sale and stuff like that. So we're kind of covering 1965 to like 1969.
That's perfect, man. That's what I want to see. I will definitely be there on Sunday at the Cutting Room in Manhattan.
Yep.
It's not too late a show. I think you sit down at that place. So no excuse not to go. Tonight, Kung Fu Necktie, Space Ballroom on Monday, Boston on Wednesday, and tomorrow, Cutting Room, New York City. Mike, enjoy your soy latte, buddy.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. And thank you to everybody that's been coming out. And if you can make it out, we appreciate it. If you can't, that's okay. Just tell your friends. Maybe they can make it out.
Yeah. I'll be there, buddy. All right. I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah, it's tomorrow, right?
All right.
Thanks, Mike Randall.
See you tomorrow.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
They're back of a van. Mike Randall, are you there? Are you there? You should be there now. Oh, geez. Well, folks, I tried to have Mike Randall on, I swear. Are you there, Mike?
I'm here, right here.
Thank God. Mike Randall, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, Michael?
Good. I know you're in California. It's a little early to wake you up, so appreciate
it. Saturday morning.
So Arthur Lee just passed away, and Love, always, you know, somebody we play on the station, on the show a lot. And I know that you toured with Arthur for about 14 years?
Yeah, off and on since 1993, 13 years or so.
And, I mean, it must be tough being out of a job now. But, I mean, I saw you guys play with him a number of times, and, you know, the shows were always pretty fantastic. Tell me a little bit about how you guys met up with Arthur, and because I know he, you know, after Love, he went through sort of a bunch of different bands before he finally found you guys and you know, kind of got back going. And once he sort of hooked up with Baby Lemonade, it seems like the career for Arthur, you know, started to develop some steam again, and he sort of started to get some of the due that maybe he deserved.
Well, believe it or not, I had actually wasn't even really aware of Love before like 1987.
Because you were just listening to NRBQ all the time? Jerky Boys albums?
But Rusty, the other guitar player, he and also the other singer in Baby Lemonade, he and some friends used to check Arthur out like in 90, 91. And, you know, he said that Arthur was all right back then. You know, the bands were a little, you know, pickup-y sounding, but, you know, you go to a show and it'd be like 30 or 40 people there and stuff. And then we handed our demo to a guy who was booking Arthur one time in 92. We just happened to, we worked at a record store, and he was buying some Love records. And we said, oh, we're fans. And he's like, oh, I book Arthur. So we handed him a demo. And a few months later, he gave us a call. He said, hey, the opening act dropped out at the Troubadour show. It's like April 93. And it offered us the slot, and we played the show, and Arthur, like, he had loved us. He's like, you know, those guys remind me of my original band. And then we immediately started playing shows with them and stuff.
One thing about the original Love and Baby Lemonade, both are, you know, integrated bands that don't at all, that have no, you know, color sound to them. You know, it just happens to be some white guys and some black guys. Do you think that in some way is what draw him to you guys?
I, you know, the more people ask me that, the more I agree. I think so, because Arthur never liked to be pigeonholed. I mean, Arthur liked every kind of music you could imagine. I mean, he could get into anything. He liked everything. But he really didn't like to be like a white band or a black band or a Mexican band. He always wanted to be in a position where the critics couldn't pigeonhole him. And he actually said he'd like that about Baby Lemonade. He actually told me that him and Johnny made love like that on purpose. But he actually thought that Baby Lemonade did it on purpose, too. It just happened to be the way Baby Lemonade was. But he definitely told me he made a concerted effort to make the original band like that.
Yeah, well, Love is very, you know, you listen to a Love record, and especially those first four records, and you know it's Love right away. Those songs are, I think Robert Plant, I read, he describes it as Baroque rock and roll. And some of those songs are really complicated. Was it hard learning that catalog?
Yeah, it was. those guys on the first four records, those musicians are incredible.
Yeah.
and very creative.
And the arrangements are just tricky, you know,
mm-hmm.
in a very subtle way.
It was challenging, but in the fun way.
Yeah.
You know, like I always think of like maybe an actor learning a very difficult role, you know?
A lot of lines.
It's hard, but there's a lot of reward in it.
Well, one of the things that I liked about the way you guys approached the music was it wasn't some sort of anachronistic, you know, like an oldies band. You guys put your own sort of stamp on it, and it was very contemporary sounding. It had a lot more energy, a lot more, you know, balls to it, sort of. You know, it was
thank you.
It was,
you know,
fatter.
What? Honestly, I mean, that worked in our favor, in that Arthur wanted, loved music to have a more edgier live sound. He didn't want us to play the parts like the record. We could have. He didn't want that. He wanted our personality in the music so that the music would sound viable and today.
Hmm. Yeah, it was a nice kind of, you know, it walked the line really well. I mean, I know this guy was your friend. You traveled all over the world with him. You guys did lots of festivals in Europe. I know that was like one of your main things. Like every summer you guys were like in Germany.
Yeah.
And I mean, did he feel, was he a bitter guy? Like I should have been Jim Morrison, or what was his thing? I mean, he certainly was, he acted nutty on stage, and I'm just going to assume he was nutty off stage, too.
I think definitely Arthur had some bitterness. You know, it's no secret that Love didn't tour very much. I mean, you even talk to some of the other original members, and they'll tell you that they know, and they're pretty certain that had they taken the path the Doors taken, you know, really worked it like the other bands.
Yeah, I think they never toured in New York ever. Never played in New York City.
Yeah. Arthur had some bitterness. He always had some, I think. But in England, they loved Love, and they loved Arthur, you know, more than Love. They loved Arthur so much that, you know, magazines like Mojo gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award. NME gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award. And these things really touched him. They meant a lot to him. And I think they probably meant more than even making a lot of money.
Hmm.
To finally get that recognition, you know, after, you know, years and years of hard times in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, it seemed like he was a guy who liked to party. Is that accurate?
What'd you say?
He liked to party.
Who, Arthur?
Yeah. I mean, that's a nice way of saying it, Mike.
He's from the 60s, man. Everybody
right.
in the 60s are quite liberal with the extracurricular pharmaceuticals, you know?
Yeah, well, he seemed to just be kind of a, you know, a combination of like a real idiosyncratic guy, like they broke the mold, and,
yeah.
you know, this sort of anger, and then whatever he was drinking or doing drugs or whatever, I don't know. But, you know, it seemed like all those different factors really create this exciting but scary time bomb kind of a personality.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with Arthur, obviously. I mean, I spent there. You know, we did one stretch. We spent 4 months in a row. So, I mean, I would spend every day with Arthur for 4 months.
Wow.
And live to tell about it. But,
did he? I mean, did he show genius?
He could be the most beautiful person in the world. And sometimes he was quite angry. But, you know, he was never specifically angry at people. He's angry at other things. But I don't know. I never really figured out exactly what he was angry at.
Yeah, I used to see him go off on the audience like for nothing, you know, like off on like Mickey Mantle one day at one gig. You know, it's like Mickey Mantle.
Well,
you know,
the funniest thing I remember, we played the Bowery Ballroom in like 2002, and some of the guys from Oasis and Soundtracks of Our Lives were at the show, and they're up in the balcony, and someone yelled down about Bruce Springsteen being the boss, And then Arthur said, you know, F Bruce Springsteen, God is the boss. And, you know, that only Arthur Lee can say that, would say that.
Nice comeback.
That's the way Arthur thinks.
Was he into God? Was he a spiritual guy?
He was. He was, believe it or not.
So who else, when, you know, 14 years on and off with Arthur, you must have crossed paths with all kinds of people coming to pay their respects.
Especially in England. But the cool thing is we play the States, and, like, every city that was a major city we get to, the particular indie celebrity in that town would come to the show. Like, we were in Cleveland, and the guys from, GBV something? Guided by Voices?
Uh-huh, Guided by Robert Pollard?
Yeah, all those guys came, all of them came to the show. Huh. And they all, like, you know, stayed and just talked to us after the show. It was like, you know, they really want to see Arthur, and some of them had seen him before, but to hear the music played in a way that you could get both to see the guy that you really, really respect and to hear the music sound great. I mean, that was just a combination that a lot of people appreciated.
Yeah, it was so not lame. You know, I mean, there was nothing lame about the show. And so often you go see these guys and it's just like an exercise in, you know, just you're going to see them and kind of support them, but the music stinks, you know.
And, yeah, it wasn't no Merry Prankster.
Right. Oh, yeah. Hey, what are you doing now? What are the plans for Baby Lemonade? Are you still going to do something love-related?
Well, Baby Lemonade.
Are you still going to play with Johnny Eccles?
We've been getting together and writing songs. And this is before, I mean, this is when, you know, Arthur was just sick, but we were getting together writing songs anyways.
Right, there was a plan I'd heard for you guys and Arthur to sort of collaborate on a brand new love album with new songs.
Well, Rusty and Arthur and I worked on about five songs, writing-wise, that were finished, and then about another three or four that are not finished, that never got finished. And then
Dave
Chappell, our bass player and drummer, you know, we went in the studio and we worked on it as much as we could with Arthur, and I think he recorded some of it. But then there's about four songs that are unfinished that we're actually have been working on finishing now that we were just going to do for Baby Lemonade. I just had dinner with Johnny Eccles the other night, Johnny has been writing some stuff, and he's also been finishing two projects. So next time Johnny's in L.A., he's going to come down to our studio just for the heck of it. You know, we've been just to get him to sit down with us and jam and maybe help us finish writing some of these, you know. We don't really know. We're trying to music's in our blood. But, you know, there's only one. There'll ever only be one Arthur Lee. And, you know, he's missed beyond words can even describe.
Yeah, he was certainly one of those guys whose influence goes, you know, really far. And he's one of those guys, one of those bands that musicians all seem to know and have the records, you know. May not have, you know, cracked the top 40 too often, but every musician seems to have those records. He's one of those guys that also, it took me a while to really get into the Love catalog before I really sort of appreciate it. It was just too complicated or something. It wasn't immediate enough. I had to sort of mature a little before I could appreciate it.
It wasn't like interesting. We toured with the Zombies, and you listen to so many of the songs and you immediately know them.
Right.
But you get tired of them faster.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I love them. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Those are like 2-minute pop songs, and they're like a piece of birthday cake. But you can't eat cake every day, every meal. Well, Mike, Baby Lemonade has a lot of records on a bunch of different labels, and I know you've got two solo albums. And I'm sure you guys are all over the web. Folks can find you, and folks in L.A. hopefully can see you guys play soon, and maybe you'll be back here doing a thing with Johnny Eccles. Or is there anyone else from Love who's still around?
Yeah, well, Michael Stewart Ware, the drummer from the Capo and Forever Changes, he actually came out to L.A. in June, and we played a benefit for Arthur when he was in the hospital. Right. And he played with us, so it was Baby Lemonade with him and... You know, Michael Stewart Ware came up and played about five songs on drums, and and Dave Green would play percussion, and then Michael Stuhlware would play some percussion.
How's his drumming?
His drumming was great.
Oh, great.
He played, you know, a lot of the stuff from the first album, like Can't Explain and stuff like that, and Sign DC. I've met Snoopy. Snoopy is somewhere up in Washington.
He was the drummer who got switched to keyboards later, right?
He's a drummer to what?
He got switched to keyboards later?
Yes. Yes, and the original Love drummer, Don Conca, was Arthur's, basically his lifetime best friend. Huh. Don OD'd about 2 years ago, two Septembers ago.
Huh.
And that was a really, really sad time, and I think a real turning point with Arthur, too, because musically, everything just kind of didn't seem as fun anymore, you know? We couldn't finish the writing. The performances started to become lackluster. I think Don Conca's death was more significant than any of us really imagined. Mm. But I'll tell you, Arthur's funeral, it was beautiful. It was sad. It was kind of surreal. The hat that he used to wear was actually on his casket, and it brought everyone tears. People loved him, and you know, he was a beautiful guy. He could be a difficult guy, you know, like you can imagine. But he had a great heart, and he had a sense of humor that he could make you laugh every minute of the day.
It sounds like fun.
At the funeral, one of his relatives was crying his heart out. He came up to me and my wife Hannah, and he said, "Please don't stop the music, man. Don't let people forget about him again. Don't stop the music. Keep it going." That was really touching.
Yeah, that's tough. That puts you guys in a spot. I hope you don't stop the music. Like I said, Love was really one of those special bands, and Arthur, you know, gets most of the credit for it. And the records are, like I said, real interesting. And yeah, I guess you guys are in a big way responsible for sort of, I think, for, you know, the last 10 years and all the press and the excitement generated. And
thanks, man. Well, you know, things really, really, I mean, you have to really be in L.A. And it's really interesting because, you know, Arthur used to play in L.A., and some people would go see him, but, I mean, a lot of people gave him up for dead, honestly. And once we started playing and the press started to print that the music started to sound like the music again, basically it took off from there. So it was like a good thing of Arthur meeting us and us meeting Arthur at the same time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, like I said, I saw the show a bunch of times, and it was always fantastic, and, you know, I you know, it was just great, you know. I couldn't have seen Love at the Whiskey Go-Go, so this was like as close as you're gonna get, you know? Well, Mike, I want to wrap it up by playing some Love song. I've got the Love Story box set here, which came out on Elektra a few years
great.
ago. Anything off that you want to hear?
I would love to hear K-Vita, if it's on there.
Yeah, I think it's on here. Hold on.
It'd probably be on the second disc. Rhino broke up Forever Changes. I think they played half of Forever Changes on disc one, the other half on disc two.
But then they put out Forever Changes with bonus tracks.
Oh, the Johnny Eccles one or something? What?
No, they put out they put out the whole Forever Changes album also. So.
Oh yeah.
Well, Mike Randall, any last thoughts? Any last words about Arthur Lee's passing, or Love, or the future?
I just want to say that all of us, we're going to miss Arthur. You know, actually, Arthur singled me out in a letter at the funeral that was written by his wife. And I guess he had more love for me than I ever really imagined, because he took the time out to say that in his letter. And I really appreciate that. It touched me.
Well, it seemed like you were the guy, the only person who could sort of get through to Arthur for a while.
That's why I was the guy that fought him all the time.
Well, that's sometimes what a friend has to do. And it seemed like also you were sort of Arthur's spokesman for a while, even when he was still alive. If people needed to know what was going on with Love, they would call you, not Arthur, because, you know.
And that's why I get all the hate mail.
Yeah, you know, you wrote all these diaries about your touring experiences on Love, with Love, and they're really interesting. You know, you're going all around the country and just meeting fans and people, and, and your own point of view is very interesting and full of good humor. Now, I know folks, if they just search Mike Randall Love Tour Diaries, can find it pretty easily. I was reading some of them last night, and there's like, you could write, maybe publish a book. I mean, there's lots and
lots. It's just surpassed 700 last week.
Someone should put this stuff in a book. Well, Mike, I hope some folks get in touch with you. I hope love continues, and I hope, you know, next time we talk, it's about, you know, you guys coming to town to play some shows. And maybe,
well, I'll keep you posted if you have me again on WFMU.
I will, brother. All right, let's hear from Love. And, Mike, you can go back to sleep. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Sorry to hear about Arthur.
Thank you.
All right, bye, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, there is a Love and Alone Again, or that's the alternate mix right here on the mighty WFMU. And joining us on the phone, Johnny Eccles, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm just fine, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing okay. I've got a sort of a flooding basement situation that's kind of bumming my scene out a little bit, but I'm not going to let it get me down.
I'm sorry, has it raining there?
It's been raining a little bit, like every day for, it seems like, about 3 months. It's just been crazy. Today's beautiful, though. So.
Well, I'm jealous. It hasn't rained here for a while, and it gets to be up to around 115 just about every day here.
You're out in the desert in Arizona, is that right?
Yeah. Yep, right out in the middle of the desert.
How did you land there, of all places?
Well, it's Sedona, and it's probably one of the prettiest places on Earth with the beautiful red rock scenery. It's like living in the Grand Canyon.
Hmm.
And we played here years and years ago, and I loved it, so I had a chance to get a house here, and so here I am.
Yeah. Born in 1947 in Memphis, Tennessee, and moved to Los Angeles at the age of 5 or 6, is that right?
That's right.
And Arthur Lee, also born in Memphis, and his parents were friends with your parents, and they moved to L.A. right about the same time, and you both wound up in the same high school, right? Dorsey High School.
Correct, yeah.
Tell me about music. I mean, what kind of music were you listening to? I guess you were, you know, 10 years old in 1957. You know, you were 15 in, the early 60s. It sounds like there was such a lot of great music to be listened to in that sort of influential period for you. What were you listening to?
Oh, gosh, we listened to just about everything, really. There was no specific type of music, but I did kind of prefer jazz and blues, but I really, other than that as a preference, we listened to just about everything.
Hmm. And I think in high school, maybe, you started... Did you start playing music in the band, sort of, you know, playing an orchestra instrument, or did you start with the guitar?
No, I played trumpet in the band. I played trumpet from junior high school all the way through high school and into college.
Ah, so you can read, you're a real musician.
Yeah, I'm a real musician.
That's kind of must have, well, trumpet certainly is a big part of the Love sound. You're in high school, and you run into Arthur Lee, who was a jock, right? He was a baseball player, basketball player, a track star.
Right, he was a basketball player. He had broken the school record in basketball. But no, we didn't run into each other. We had lived next door to each other since we were a kid.
Huh.
So we had known each other, as I said, a long, long time. So we would have talent shows at school. So Billy Preston and Marilyn McCoo of the Fifth Dimension, we all went to school together.
Hmm.
And so we would play talent shows and assemblies and things like that. And Arthur saw us playing, and all of the Billy and I were able to fool all the girls. So Arthur kind of got jealous of that and wanted to get in on it. So he started playing the Kunga drums with us for a while, and it went from there.
I never heard that. Now, I know that in the early days, Arthur played keyboards. Is that right? He played organ, right?
That's correct. He played organ.
Was he good on the organ?
Yeah, he was very good on the organ. As a matter of fact, that was his instrument. He wasn't very much of a guitar player, but he was a fine keyboard player.
And I know he plays drums on most of the first Love album, doesn't he?
On a couple of songs he played, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing, certainly a guy who sort of hit by lightning, you know, just in terms of the talent he had and the inspiration he had. It just seemed very unique.
Yeah, well, we weren't, you know, as I said, weren't aware of his musical abilities until after the assemblies.
His conga drumming didn't bowl you over there.
No, it didn't.
So you guys, Billy Preston, and you guys started a band called the LAGs, the
right.
Lags, sort of like the MGs, but the Los Angeles group, right?
Right, the Los Angeles group.
And you start playing around town. Is that basically the idea?
That's correct. We played around town, and we started to build up a following. And
you guys were still in high school, though, right?
Yeah, still in high school.
Is it true that you wore false mustaches to try to look a little bit older?
Right, yeah, because playing at the clubs, you had to be an adult or 21, and so we had these little mustaches, or we'd wear these stingy brim hats or whatever we could do to make people think we were older, and you know, but they knew as long as we stayed away from the bars, it was okay.
Yeah, and apparently some guy, because you guys were versatile, started booking you under the names of more famous bands. Like, people wouldn't know that you weren't the Coasters, so he would book you as the Coasters. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. He'd get people together and book us as the Coasters, the Drifters, Booker T and the MGs, anybody that was popular at the time. This guy, Don Podler, he's not here anymore, so I'll mention his name.
Please,
Don Podler. And so, yeah, we've been everybody, so I'm sure lots of people at seen us and not really realized.
That's I mean, did people say, gee, I thought the Coasters were older than 16?
Yeah. But we'd be playing frat parties mostly, so after a few kegs, it didn't matter.
Who cares? Yeah. And how much did a gig like that pay, being the fake Coasters in, you know, 1962 or whatever?
I think we got about $25 each, which was a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
Because you could rent an apartment for $80 a month, so that was quite a large sum for us.
And I heard that a teacher once sort of happened to be at one of the Coasters, quote-unquote, gigs, and knew it wasn't the Coasters.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
What did he do?
Well, you know, it was kind of funny after, you know, the initial shock wore off. You know, he kind of laughed about it. So he didn't cause any trouble or give us up or anything. But
so, in 1963, you're still a young man, and somehow you get invited to go to England and back up Little Richard, right?
Right. Yeah, we'd known Little Richard. He was a friend of Billy Preston, so I knew him since I was a little tyke. So I had played with him on several of his records as a child, and he decided that he wanted to take us to Europe, and so we went to England. That's where we met the Beatles when I was still in high school.
Amazing. So what Little Richard records do you play on?
Oh, gosh, it was... These weren't the original records. These were like when he did
he was on OK,
covered his own records and stuff. Because no, I didn't play on the early 50s ones. Just when he would cover his own albums.
He still made some great records though in that sort of early 60s period. I'd love to figure out exactly which ones you're on.
Yeah, and one of the religious ones. You got what you wanted, but you lost what you had. I believe that was it. That was the title of it, yeah, and I played on that with him. But
and those were recorded in Los Angeles?
Yeah, with Bumps Blackwell in the Gold Star Studio, actually.
What fun. How exciting for a little kid. And so you're out in 1963, you're out in the UK backing up Little Richard, meeting the Beatles. Did you know at that point there's no turning back for me? I'm not going to be a plumber or a doctor or anything. It's going to be rock and roll?
I knew. I had known for a long time that's what I was going to do. That was my calling. So, you know, my mom wasn't too happy with it, but, you know.
Tell me about Little Richard. Was he a nut off the stage?
Yeah, he's basically the same off the stage as he is on the stage. Everything, the sun rises and sets on Richard, so.
Yeah. But fun and a good musician, and he, I've seen him play, and it seems like he cares about the band sounding good, unlike some guys in his position who just kind of go out there and do the show. He seemed to keep the band in shape, you know? Was it that way back then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, he's definitely not a Chuck Berry. He definitely wants his band to be able to play and play the music right, you know?
Yeah. So you come back to Los Angeles, and yourself and Arthur Lee, Billy Preston, and Jimi Hendrix, who's known as Jimmy James at that point,
right.
More or less, you guys become the house band at L.A.'s California Club. You're playing, I don't know, probably a few hours a night, and also backing up touring acts that come through town, right?
That's right, yeah.
So tell me about that. You would just play, sort of figure out the hits of the day, or were there any originals thrown in there as well?
Mostly as a backup group, they would bring their charts, you know, for whatever hits that they had, and we'd play them, ZZ Hill or B.B. King, whatever, so many groups, because that was part of the so-called Chitlin Circuit, the California Club, so.
Oh, what neighborhood was that in?
That was on Santa Barbara. Gosh, I don't recall the side street of that, but... that was in the west side of Los Angeles, but it was a fairly large club, and so all of the groups would come through there, the OJs, the Isley Brothers, and whatever group was, you know, had hit records at the time would come through there.
You know, I was talking to Howard Kalin from the Turtles, was our guest last week, and he did the exact same thing, I guess, on the other side of town, you know, backing up all those guys. It sort of sounds like a great way to sort of get your chops really together.
Absolutely, because you had to be on time and on the money right then and there. You didn't have a whole lot of time to rehearse. Sometimes you didn't rehearse at all, but... So you had to. It was a great learning experience.
And how did that band evolve into Love?
Well, we started playing at a place in Montebello called Beverly Bowl. And by then, Billy Preston wasn't with us, and of course, Jimmy wasn't. And we stayed there for probably 6 months or so, and we developed a pretty large following there. And then we had an opportunity to play a place called the Brave New World, which was a gay bar. And the guy wanted to change over, but he didn't pay us initially. So he just wanted to change from a gay bar to a straight bar. And so we played there for probably 5 or 6 months. And by then we'd met Brian. And Brian was kind of the gadfly, you know, he was the Byrds' road manager, and everybody knew him, so...
You're talking about Brian McLean, who was a guitar player, songwriter in Love.
Pardon me, I didn't hear you.
I said, you're talking about Brian McLean, who...
Yes, Brian McLean, so...
Not everybody knows.
Right, okay, I'm sorry. So after we ran into Brian and found out how well he could play, we invited him to join the group. And he brought with him a whole lot of folks because they were the Byrds people that, you know, would come and see them. And since they knew Brian being their road manager, they would all show up. And so that's basically where Love started playing at the Brave New World, because we developed a huge, huge following there. As a matter of fact, the fire marshal got to know us very well.
I mean, what was the scene like? What year is that it's definitely Love and Brian joins the band?
That would be 65.
And what was the scene like in Los Angeles? Were there a million bands, or were rock and roll bands still sort of a rarity?
No, they were just starting. That scene was just starting up because there were lots of small clubs and venues there. The Green Onion, I think, and Pandora's Box, and lots of little clubs. And so it just kind of started all of a sudden around 64, 65. There started to be in Hollywood a club on every other corner.
Hmm. And it sounds like a lot of fun. Was it just simply a lot of fun, or was it heavy?
No, it was a lot of fun, actually. That's, you know, and we were young guys, and all of the chicks would show up, and so that we were living in heaven then, you know, being musicians, you know.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. Yeah. Not everybody knows the Music of Love. We've heard some just before the interview, and it's a lot of it's very complicated music. Did it start out being complicated?
No, it didn't. Actually, we started out kind of covering other groups in the top 40 songs at the time, and then we kind of gradually worked into writing our own material, and so it was kind of a gradual thing.
Hmm. So there's definitely a huge buzz about the band Love, and Jacques Holtzman from Elektra really hasn't signed any rock bands at that time, and it's funny because you can see sort of an explosion in the record industry at that time. Everybody runs out to try to grab their rock band or their, you know, what they think is going to be the Beatles for them, and he signs you and the Doors, become sort of the two bands on Elektra that
right.
that get signed, and you make your first record, which has a cover version of My Little Red Book, the Burt Bacharach song,
right?
And that's, I think, 1966, right?
Right, yeah.
And that's sort of a hit for you guys, right off the bat.
Yeah, and we did that in Hey Joe.
Right.
Which was there's a strange story about that. It was kind of a folk song, and we had played that quite a bit at the time, and people were really getting into Hey Joe, so we were going to release it on our first album, and Bob Lee from The Leaves asked me the words to it, and so I made up a whole bunch of words just, you know, because we wanted to release the song first, and so I gave him all the wrong words, and that ended up being, you know, the hit record, you know, they had the hit with it, and still the wrong words.
That's very funny. So you wrote the incorrect words that now everybody knows?
That's right.
That's hysterical. That's right. How funny. When Arthur would write songs, because he was not a natural on guitar, did he write them on guitar? Did he just write the melody in his head? Did he use a keyboard? How did he write a song, and how did he bring it into the band?
Mostly he would do things on the guitar, but he didn't know a whole lot of chords, so he would kind of use the chord as a kind of rhythm sounding board, and he'd play them for me or try to play it and sing the song, and I would kind of interpret what he was playing and teach the rest of the guys what key and what chords the song had, and we'd go from there.
Hmm. The band was a biracial band, I guess is how to say it. There was white guys and African-American guys in the band. Was that a problem at all in Los Angeles?
Not in Los Angeles, no. It was perfectly fine in Los Angeles. It was just, it kind of held us back playing anywhere else. Like in the South, we couldn't play at all because they, you know, if you were a black group or a white group, of course, you know, you're fine. But if you were an integrated group back during that time when all the turmoil was happening, you just didn't play.
Yeah.
And so that ended up being a hindrance for us.
I'd always heard that Arthur simply did not want to tour with that band. Love never sort of was one of those bands that got in the Dick Clark bus, you know, and played those shows all around the country, you know.
No, we weren't the kind of group that would have played Dick Clark's things, but no, that's untrue. We weren't independently wealthy. We wanted to play, and we played wherever we could, but most of the times we got offers that were either similar or better to play on the West Coast, and that's why we stayed there. Say we were offered, say, $5,000 to $10,000 to play, say, in the Earl Warren Showgrounds in Santa Barbara. Okay, now if we got the same offer to play in Detroit, it didn't make sense to go all the way to Detroit and take our instruments and pay for air freight and all of that when we could make the same money by playing in Santa Barbara or San Francisco, Sacramento. You know,
yeah.
California's a huge state, so.
Yeah, it sure is. The first album is co-produced by Jack Holtzman, who founded Elektra. Did he really co-produce that record?
Yeah, actually he did.
And was he, yeah. Did he have a good sense of music? I mean, was his well-roundedness, did that sort of help out, do you think?
Well, he'd been an engineer for years and years, so he knew his way around the board. And he didn't offer a lot of suggestions, you know, other than they tried to tell us, well, we'll fix it in the mix, meaning they wanted our guitars to sound a certain way. And I had found out a long time ago that if you didn't get the sound you wanted in the studio, you didn't get it. So we had, you know, problems with him, you know, because of the loudness. We played very, very loud. And so a lot of times we, you know, butt heads with him. But other than that, he just worked the board and let us play the music.
Let me remind everybody, I'm talking to Johnny Eccles of the band Love, and they'll be in town Wednesday, August, what is the date? Is it the 5th, I think?
Yeah.
Wednesday the 5th at Maxwell's right here in Hoboken, New Jersey. And there will be the 6th up in Fairfield, Connecticut, which is a benefit for WPKN with the Blues Magoos. Friday, August 7th at the Middle East in Boston, and Sunday the 9th in New York City at BB King's. They're also playing Montreal, Milwaukee, Chicago, Toronto, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Alexandria. Information on all these dates at California66Review.com. And, of course, it's the Baby Lemonade guys and yourself and a few extra guys to sort of flesh out the sound. I cannot wait to see you myself. Let's talk about your second album, De Capo, came out in 67, and Forever Changes also came out in 67. You guys were real busy.
Right, we were. And De Capo was the first of the two, but actually Forever Changes was initially going to be a two-album set, but the record company cried poor and claimed they couldn't afford it, so it ended up.
So how far did you guys get? Because there is, I think in the, you know, liner notes to the Love Story, which is a two-CD box set Rhino put out a few years ago, they sort of talk about this alleged, you know, bunch of tapes that no one can find. Was there progress on those songs? Were they written? Were they recorded ever?
Well, no, they weren't recorded. They were just started. You know, like the songs on Forever Changes, we would get kind of an idea going and flesh it out in the studio. But when they changed it from the two albums to the one album, we had kind of a lot of conflicts going then, so it made putting that together kind of an unhappy experience, because, you know, everybody had planned on doing it the other way, and so it was quite a disappointment for the members of the group.
It's interesting because it's one of those records that, like Pet Sounds or Sgt. Pepper, gets listed in, you know, the top rock albums ever, and it's an amazing album. And it's one of those albums that you can listen to start to finish, and it feels like a whole piece. And I can't imagine it being a double record set, you know? Maybe being a single record set, you sort of had the best pieces all there, and you know, wouldn't have had such an impact as a double record. Who knows?
Well, right, who knows? But, you know, there were lots of songs that were started that we just didn't finish because of the fact that, you know, we weren't going to be able to record the two albums. So that's what I'm working on now, the songs that we started and that we just didn't finish. And
and are you doing that from memory, or are there notes? Are there in demos anything to help you with that process?
Mostly it's just from memory.
So
and
you're
that's making it difficult. I'm working with David Angel, the gentleman who was the arranger for all of the strings and horns on Forever Changes. We're working together to put this thing together and finish it.
And are you going to try to record it with the Baby Lemonade guys, or what's the plan there?
Yeah, they will play on some of the songs and other musicians also, but Baby Lemonade will be the backbone.
How exciting. That sounds great. Some of the records are arranged in an incredibly intricate way, and you've sort of said that it was a group effort to arrange the songs, but tell me just a little bit about the process, you know, in the studio, how some of those more complex things got worked out.
Well,
because
each person would kind of work out their own parts. Like, we were kind of an experimental group, so when we started working on a song, we'd play it different ways, and everybody would add their input, and it it would take a couple of hours, or, you know, maybe three or four on some of the songs, but, you know, it takes several hours putting together our different arrangements of how this went and how that went. And
but this is in a rehearsal or in the studio?
This was actually, and we were one of those kinds of groups that, that fleshed everything out in the studio. We would rehearse get kind of the basics of the songs and the chord structure down, but we would change it all in the studio. That's just the way it worked out.
Now, right after Forever Changes comes out, really just a few months later, Arthur Lee fires the whole band. Is that sort of how...
No, he didn't fire anybody. Everybody just decided it was time to go our separate ways because we... there wasn't a lot of work there, as I said, after... let's see, from 68 on, we were getting lots of work on the West Coast, but nowhere else, you know. And so after playing the same places over and over again, you know, we weren't wealthy. We needed work, and we weren't getting it. So we kind of, and also we were heavy into drugs by then, and we just kind of drifted apart.
You and Ken Forsey were convicted of robbing a bunch of donut shops. You guys were known as the Donut Bandits.
See, that's some kind of urban legend that never happened.
It's just not true?
No, of course not.
Really?
No, if anybody had bothered to check, they keep those kinds of records at the Hall of Records in Los Angeles. Anybody can go and check and find out. I wasn't in any prison in my life, you know. No,
that's an amazing story. During in the liner notes for the Love Story CD, it says that, and it also is very interestingly, during the time this was put out, it says that your whereabouts were unknown. So what happened to you from, you know, that time you quit Love? You know, if you weren't busy robbing donut stores, what were you doing?
I moved to New York, and I did studio work there a lot, basically playing jingles and commercials and things for Japanese and European radio, you know. I was playing with a group of people that had an end for that. So I moved to New York in 1971, and I stayed there until 1980 when I moved to Sedona, Arizona, where I am now.
And were people ever, you know, once in a while, did you get a knock on the door or a letter and say, hey, you're that Love guy, you know, do you want to get back together? Was there ever talk of that?
Yeah, we talked about getting back together all the time. Arthur wanted us to get the group back together from a few weeks after we broke up. But, because Arthur went on the road and he would get booed and they would throw tomatoes at him, and because they would say they were imposters, you know. They called them ham-fisted imposters.
Yeah, they did. He did sort of get a couple different really versions of Love, and it was never the same.
Yeah. That's right, and the people didn't accept them as the same, so he was having a hard time with that, and so he did try to get the group back together, but We tried in 69. We played the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, and it just didn't have the same magic.
Let's talk about the drugs for just a minute. It seems like that was such a pervasive thing in Los Angeles in, you know, 67, 68. But it sort of seems like in some ways maybe the music wouldn't have happened without the drugs, or is that not true? What do you...
No, I think the drugs was kind of... You know, it was kind of a natural progression for the group, but, you know, we were going through so many changes that the drugs were kind of, it sounds cliche-ish now, but it was kind of a self-medication thing, you know, kind of trying to deal with the fact that we were watching everything fall apart, and then we had this Vietnam War that everybody was scared to death that they were going to be snatched away from, you know, our Garden of Eden and sent over somewhere to die. So, you know, we were right at that age, and that was a big part of it. But drugs was, you know, our way of coping with it.
The records were never giant sellers, but they all sold, and they all continued to sell, and they still continue to sell.
Right, and they still sell.
Do you participate in making money as a member of Love? Did you ever make money? Were you fairly taken care of?
I don't necessarily think it was fairly, but yeah, we were paid, and we still are paid for royalties for the records that we did.
That's good. And you're a co-writer of a few of the songs, so that that must help a little bit.
Right. Yeah, and that was the reason that we signed with Elektra, was they were the only record company back then that would allow us to own the publishing to our own music. Everybody else wanted you to sign with their publishing company, and that was one of the big pieces of advice that Little Richard had given us. You know, he said, always own your own music, don't let anybody take it from you. And so I took that to heart, and I kind of took a lot of heat for that, but I insisted when we talked to Jack Holtzman that we own the publishing, and the first discussion he wasn't going for it, so they thought that, you know, we were going to miss out on that, but he finally agreed that we could own the publishing.
Wow. For Arthur, that must have been a huge change in his life. I mean, if he had caved in on that, it would have been a very different life for Arthur Lee.
Absolutely. It would have been a totally different life.
I've seen you play with Baby Lemonade before, and I've seen, Arthur and Baby Lemonade and you many times. And what they do with the music, and they've backed up Arthur now for almost 20 years. They've been Love essentially for about 20 years or so. What's amazing is that they bring, absolute clarity to the music. There's nothing half-assed about it, but they also bring a little bit of energy, they haven't modernized the music, and they're very reverent to the original arrangements, but there's a little bit of live energy, like I imagine Love used to be.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's why I ended up playing with them, because the type of people they are, number one, but also the way they played the music, they understood it, and so when we play live, you have the feeling that you're listening to Love. You know, you don't get the feeling that, there's a backup group. You actually get the feeling that you're listening to the original group.
Yeah, I agree. The California 66 review, it was supposed to be Sky Saxon, who had to go and pass away on us.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be the Electric Prunes, who had to go and cancel on us.
Right.
And so it's really Love, one show with the Blues Magoos, and a few shows with Jerry Miller of Moby Grape.
Correct.
And information on all of this is at California66Review.com. You've got a website, a MySpace page, myspace.com/Johnny Eccles, and there's some information stuff about that. You've got shows coming up in Hoboken. That's this Wednesday at the wonderful Maxwell's, Fairfield, Connecticut, Cambridge, Mass., Montreal, August 9th in New York City at B.B. King's, which is a nice place to play, Milwaukee, Chicago, Toronto, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Virginia. Are you excited about this? Are you in some ways, are you just like,
I'm looking forward to it. Actually, this we haven't played in a little while, so this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be fun. What can folks expect besides, is it just going to be, a real cross section of great Love music?
That's right, and it'll be a cross section. We for the last few years we had been touring playing Forever Changes mostly, but now we're going to play from all of the albums. We're going to play a little bit from the first three, and probably three or four songs from each album, and then the rest would be from Forever Changes.
And you talked about sort of this Forever Changes, side three and four.
Right, Gethsemane.
Yeah, and what's the due date on that? Do you have a feeling?
No, because it should be sometime in the next several months, but we're still working on it, and David Angel lives in Switzerland, so we don't get together that often, so it's taking more time than it would, if we were together in the same space. And he's kind of a Luddite, he doesn't like to do things with computers, the technophobe.
Wow.
We have to be in the same space you know, in order for it to work. And so we can't, you know, send each other, you know, MP3s back and forth or anything.
Amazing. Well, it's time to get out of, you know, the 115-degree weather and...
Yeah, definitely. That's what I'm looking forward to, actually, is getting out of this, because this is oppressive. It's not normally like this in the mountains here. It's... But some, you know, our global warming, I guess, is caught up to us here. So
yeah, I've got K Vita queued up here in my CD player.
Uh-huh.
Got any insight on that song for us, or on the recording, or in?
That was with Hassinger, I believe, when we recorded that at the RCA Studios, and I believe Snoopy is playing the harpsichord on that.
Snoopy played drums for a while and then sort of got moved to keyboards.
Right? Yeah, he got moved to keyboards because he was not much of a drummer, and Arthur liked him. I couldn't stand him, but Arthur liked him. So,
as a person or as a drummer?
I couldn't stand him as a drummer or a person. He was one of those people that, you know, we used to use the term square, and Snoopy was the epitome of a square person.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
We just didn't have anything in common, and I know as his parents were anthropologists, they worked with the Lakes in Kenya, and so Snoopy kind of raised himself, and he had a different outlook. Yeah. If you saw our DVD, you may have seen Snoopy and the way he appeared in those...
In his treehouse.
Yeah, that's the... So he was definitely... an eccentric person even back then, and eccentric in a way that was not necessarily conducive to one wanting to be around him a lot. I'll put it that way.
Okay, very good. Well, we're going to hear this song now, and we're going to come see you this Wednesday at Maxwell's in Hoboken, New Jersey, or when is it? It's Sunday, August 9th in New York City at B.B. King's, and all those other dates, Cambridge, Chicago, Toronto, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Milwaukee, Montreal, Alexandria, up in Connecticut. Folks can check out California66Review.com. For all the information on that. Johnny Eccles, it's a really interesting story, and there's so much wrong information out there. I'm glad we could clear some of it up.
Well, good. I hope it was an interesting interview.
It was for me.
Okay.
All right, I'll see you on Wednesday night at Maxwell's. Thanks so much, Johnny.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, it is the desert waiting for the rain there from Mike Randall from My Music Loves You Even If I Don't, from, like I said, from 2000. What a number one hit record that is. Just sometimes the bizarro world and the real world collide. That song really could have been, I think, a number one hit record. So Mike Randall has solo records. He's made a lot of records with his band called Baby Lemonade, and for years and years he backed up Arthur Lee in Love. And good morning, Michael. You're on the phone. How are you?
I'm doing great, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I know you're in Los Angeles. It's even earlier than it is here, so thanks for waking up. I appreciate it.
Yes, I am. It's actually quite nice out.
Yeah, I mean, now that I've got a kid, you have two kids, you got to get up early, so you kind of like realize, oh, it's good in the morning.
That's true. You do get up, and I'm actually at my girlfriend's house, and she has a dog that gets up. So whether it's a kid or a dog, you end up early. So
yeah. Okay. Let's go. We all opened the show with a love tune this morning. How many years did you play with Arthur Lee?
I first started playing with Arthur in 1993. Baby Lemonade opened up for his the band he had put together, and then he saw us and literally fired that band that night and hired us, and I played with him until he died in 2006.
You know, it's kind of interesting because he had tried to put together a new version of Love a few different times with a few different bands, and I think you're exactly right that none of those bands really got it. I mean, they were all appreciative of the music, but nobody had anywhere close to what you guys did. And what you guys did, because I saw your version of the band many times, was you kind of took the Love thing and you made it contemporary but very, very reverent to what he had done in the 60s. But there was kind of a live energy to it, that it wasn't just like trying to recreate the thing note for note. It was like perfect Split the Difference of that, and I don't think any other band could have done it.
Thank you. Well, we definitely had a pure reverence for those records, and a lot of people that he played with were more into the Jimi Hendrix kind of jam period that Arthur, and there are a lot of fans really like. Arthur had kind of sort of abandoned the more ambitious material, as I'll put it, and just kind of went for the more, you know, crawlies and stuff, and so that's the kind of people he was playing with. And with us, particularly Rusty, because he was the musical director, we were always pushing Arthur to do the obscure stuff, and, you know, we basically convinced him to do Forever Changes.
Hmm.
It wasn't like he wanted to do it.
Huh. Yeah, and then he ended up touring with strings and horns and all that, and people would go crazy, you know, because you don't really get to see things, you know, they're straight-up 60s pop songs, but they kind of have this orchestral, baroque, you know, I don't know what it is, but it's wonderful to see that kind of thing live. And he was a complete crazy guy. I mean, there's billions of stories of him, but I'm sure life on the road with him was colorful, to say the least.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a song that I wrote that's also on that album, My Music Loves You, Out of My League. And before I ever recorded that, I used to play that by myself at soundcheck. And Arthur would go and sit and watch me play that. He said, man, I really love that song. He goes, we should write a song like that one day. And actually, it's never been released, but Rusty and I actually wrote a song with him called If Given a Wish. And it's kind of almost like a torch song.
Hmm.
And we finally got to do that, and it was really from him just listening to something I did. So he was always creatively kind of open. Rusty and I actually wrote, you know, about 7 or 8 songs with him.
Yeah, and what happened to those?
You know what? His wife has the masters. I mean, I actually have some of the demos myself. It's like they're there. They just haven't been released.
Yeah, well, I wonder why his wife wouldn't put those out. You'd think, you know, whatever new... Yeah. Interesting. And you told me you're writing a book about your time on the road called King Arthur's Court. How's that going?
It's going really well. It's like I've just kind of 4 chapters into it. I have, like, the outline, but it's mostly about my life with Arthur from, like, Baby Lemonade forming in 92, and we got the gig with Arthur. We weren't even a band for more than 5 months when we got that gig. And you know, the time his period in prison, and that was the time that coincided with Baby Lemonade being signed to Big Deal, with you being signed to Big Deal and Shona Knife and Wonderments and all of us on the same record label, which was awesome. And then the opportunity I had going out on the road with you for several years with David Green, and the book covers that, and then it covers Arthur Get Out of Jail, and it covers getting the whole, you know, team back together again, our old manager, booking agent, and going out and hitting the road in early 2000 and just setting it on fire. And then this idea of doing Forever Changes with a mini orchestra and having it, seeing it to fruition. It was a lot of work, but it was fun. And it was a lot of travel, and Arthur loved it. And, I mean, it was like he loved it so much that he realized that he had to take a huge pay cut to make it happen, and we could have done a lot of tours without strings and horns.
Huh.
And I'd rather lose money and have the music sound better.
Now,
and he didn't make us take a pay cut.
That's really interesting. What is the biggest crowd you guys played to?
We played Glastonbury Festival in the UK in the year 2002. When we got on stage, it was something like 65,000 people. By the time we finished, it was like 80,000.
Oh, man. That was insane. Yeah, I put a video up on the playlist for today's program, and I urge folks to check it out. They can see you playing with Arthur Lee. And it's just what you guys were doing is totally awesome. Also on the playlist for today's program is a link to your Kickstarter page for your new record called West of the 405. Now, I think of you, you're a really interesting guy, and I mentioned earlier that you're one of my friends that just has a lot of music in them. Excuse me. And you know, you're just always working, you're always writing songs. They all come from a real unique point of view. And you know, you're like a guy who you're so California to me. Yet you have this, you love a lot of music that's all over the map, and that's, you know, and so what comes out of you is reflective of all of that stuff.
Thank you.
And your upbringing, etc. You have good taste. So tell me what this record is all about. We're going to hear a demo that you've made, and I know that for some people who have pledged money, you're going to send them demos and stuff like that, but we're going to hear You Let Me Down, which is one of my favorites of the demos for this record. Tell me what's the story, how you're making it, what you're trying to do on Kickstarter, etc.
You got it. Well, basically, around 2015, I started writing some songs. I had moved out into my own, like, really tiny bachelor apartment in Santa Monica. You know, I had been married for, like, 8 years, and then and my wife and I decided to call it quits. You know, it was very amicable, and so I just write new songs and everything, and then I basically got a little budget together, and I was going to decide to make a record, and I was going to play all the instruments, and the engineer producer, Steve Reffling, was going to play drums. And then in May, as I was preparing to make the record, and I had saved this, you know, gotten this money together, my 17-year-old son, who's living in Brooklyn, him and his mom had a huge falling out. He came to live with me. He didn't leave until October 21st. So basically, you know, as I was recording, I was also taking care of this other person who didn't have a job and didn't have any money. And then after he leaves, I realized I had recorded, you know, 3.5 songs, but I didn't have any more money. So a friend of mine told me about Kickstarter. I really had no idea. And he just said, look, I've done it. Here's what you need to do. And so I did it. I literally, without a net, I just, what you see is what you get. It's been really fun connecting with people. And, you know, with the one exception of the one person who said they've not, you know, they questioned my pop pedigree.
Someone questioned your pop pedigree on the Kickstarter?
They messaged me. Just someone being cheeky, I guess, you know.
What does that mean? Yeah. Well, if folks want to step up, and I guess you basically can sort of pre-order a copy of the CD by going to Kickstarter and pledging right now. That's kind of how it works.
Yeah,
but there's
if we don't meet our goal, nobody pays anything, and then I go to Plan B, which I really don't know what that is yet. I haven't thought about it.
Ouch. Well, let's not hope it doesn't quite get to Plan B. So Mike Randall's Kickstarter, it has kind of a long address, so I recommend going to the playlist for today's program, and you'll see a link to it, and you can pledge. And let's hear a demo from this record. What do I need to know about this song, Mike? It's called You Let Me Down.
You know, it's really a song about how people kind of think they... You know, you think you are where you are with something in a relationship, and it turns out it's not. And you don't really learn from that, so you kind of jump into another thing, and you get the same thing. You keep wondering, why do these things keep happening? But it's really, you know, it's the main character of this story is kind of unreliable. But it's just sort of a, you know, I don't know if I want to call it a gotcha moment. But sometimes I think it's okay to be honest, and it's okay to get angry about some things. And so that's what that song's really about. It's, you know, it is blaming somebody else, not taking any responsibility. How about that?
Okay. Yeah, okay, I hear that. To me, I get a little bit of Difford and Tilbrook and a little bit of late, mid-Beach Boys when I hear this song, although it is pure Mike Randall.
You know what? I will take that, man. I will take that, especially there's a part where it says, I can't imagine, and there's like a note in there, and I said, that sounds like Squeeze.
Huh. So we're on the same page. Well,
we are on the same page.
I love you, Mike Randall, and I wish you great luck with this record and with everything you do.
I love you too, man. Thank you very much. Right. My music loves you. You're born for it.
All right. Talk to you soon. Thanks.
What's happening and how have you been? Gotta go, but I'll see you again. And oh, the music is so loud. And then I fade into the... Crowds of people standing everywhere. Across the street I'm at the slop affair. And here they always play my songs. And me, I wonder if it's... Wrong or right, they come here just the same. Telling everyone about their games. And if you think it obsolete, then you go back across the street.
Yeah.